The Grassy Narrows First Nation is located in northwestern Ontario, 80 kilometers north of Kenora. The community is the focal point of Indigenous resistance in the Treaty 3 region.
The people of Grassy Narrows First Nation have seen more than their fair share of suffering. The destructive environmental impact of many years of clear-cut logging, hydro development, mercury contamination, forced relocation, and residential schools.
You will hear the voices of community members, activists, and those involved in the logging activities around Grassy Narrows.
A starting point to the present struggle at Grassy Narrows is the hydro development on Anishinaabe lands that took place in the 1950s, which caused significant and unpredictable fluctuations in water levels, affecting wild rice beds, the habitat of fur-bearing animals, and the local fishery.
Then there was the flooding that occurred when they built the dams to make hydroelectric power, and that flooded the ricing fields that used to be a big source of food for the community, but also income because they could sell the rice. Then in and around that time and sometime later, they also opened up ricing to non-Aboriginals. At one point in time, ricing used to be only an activity that Aboriginal people could do. So they lost that source of income.
It was during this period that Grassy Narrows was relocated by Indian Affairs to its present location. This made the community accessible by road and brought a number of social and economic changes. Access to on-site schools became available, as opposed to residential schools. The move was nevertheless a social upheaval for the community.
In 1970, the community faced another challenge. The English Wabagoon River system had been contaminated by several tons of inorganic mercury over the course of the 1960s. The toxins were being dumped into the water upstream at the Dryden Pulp and Paper Mill.
When the government acknowledged the mercury poisoning and contamination, commercial fishing on the English Wabagoon River was declared illegal, and the employment rate plummeted from about 90% to 10%.
Then there was the mercury, which I believe was discovered around 1970-71 in there, and then that shut down the commercial fisheries that used to be run out of this community, and also took away a food source for the people of the community, in addition to taking away their employment. And many men used to be employed as guides at Ball Lake Lodge. Ball Lake Lodge is about 25 kilometers from this community, and at one time there would be like 100 people from the community would go spend the summer up at Ball Lake, and they worked there. Men were guiding, and some ladies were, cleaning cabins and cooking, and so it was really a thriving business at that point. And that lodge had to be shut down. And now, after the mercury, then there's the clear cutting, and the mercury is an ongoing issue. There was a scientist that was here a year and a half ago sampling all of the fish, and then also taking sediment samples from the bottom of the river, and basically it's showing that the mercury's not going away, but in fact it's traveling further downriver. So it's still very much there. So people have to continue watching that they don't eat the fish, or in moderation.
15 years passed before Canada, Ontario, and the corporate successor of the company that dumped the mercury coughed up $10 million for the people of Grassy Narrows.
The clear-cutting of the Whiskey Jack Forest by Abitibi Consolidated is only the latest instance of destruction of Anishinaabe lands in the Treaty 3 area.
Well, they've cut about 75% of his trap line.
Oh, yeah.
And they've cut like the northern three-quarters of it. So right now we're fighting very hard to try and preserve that one last little bit. And that last little bit at the south end of the trap line that hasn't been cut is meaningful to him personally, because that's where the main trapping cabin is that his dad built, and like where he spent a lot of time with his dad. And it's also the place where there's traditions when children are born, what you do with umbilical cords and things, and that's the ceremonial site for those things out at that on that south end. So anyway, yeah, they've cut 75%, and the marten particularly declined. To him, the bush is like a church. How would a mainstream person feel if someone came in and hacked the trees off the front of the church or tore the church down or whatever, you know? So for him, that's, you know, the personal. It's like losing part of his value system or his beliefs.
I'm not really totally against logging, but I'm against clear-cutting. I think, you know, that the people in Grassy can benefit, you know, in some way. There was, you know, a little bit of logging, but not to the extent that it's happening right now. If there's any logging, it would have to be selective harvesting. I think clear-cutting does a lot of damage.
There are people that say that even if there is clear-cutting, they do replant the trees right afterwards, but what are the effects that you've seen with regards to the animals and the environment even after replanting the trees?
Besides soil damage, there is erosion happening after logging. I guess replanting trees that are filled with chemicals, they put chemicals into these trees to make them grow faster. I don't think it's natural anymore. To us, you know, things that are natural are very sacred. You know, we have that connection with environment. We have a very close connection. For me, it's not the same. An artificial tree, a tree that's planted, does not have the same spiritual value as a tree that's grown naturally. A tree that's planted and modified has the same spiritual value as a plastic tree you can buy at Sears or Canadian Tire. That's the value it has spiritually.
Well, I guess I personally would not be opposed to logging if it didn't devastate the land so severely, and if they didn't, you know, spray the bush and then they kill the berries and all that goes along with the way that they're cutting now. And I can't speak for the community, but I'd probably, if they would leave the traditional land use area alone so that the people can still maintain their way of life and their culture and, you know, practice their way of life, that would be beneficial. But, you know, this community has not gained anything from the clear cutting that's gone on. They've lost everything and got nothing. And you know, the town of Kenora has thrived in the meantime.
It's really hard to describe that connection we have with nature. It's just there. It's something you don't you can't explain. Like, you have this special feeling about you know, the things around us. When the land is destroyed, when it's been clear cut, when it's been cut, it's like having something removed from us. It's a very it's an awful feeling that when that's taken away.
The community's concerns about clear-cutting by Abbotsby Consolidated were repeatedly ignored by the Federal Ministry of Indian and Northern Affairs and the Ontario Ministry of Natural Resources.
The community's struggle culminated in the establishment of a blockade on December 3rd, 2002, preventing logging trucks from entering the forest. The blockade was initiated by three young people from Grassy Narrows, who were quickly supported by a core group of other activists in the community.
We come here almost every night to make a sacred fire, so for us to be here and keep the clear cutting away and keep it from not happening, so we could be strong.
I think what it's done is, I think it's united the community. I think people now realize that that we can stop logging. I think it's making people more aware that we have to do things for ourselves.
All of a sudden, bang, one morning, there's 30 high school students standing on the road 5 kilometers north of the reserve. And that began a blockade that has been tested by the police and trucking contractors and Abitibi, Consolidated, the Ministry of Natural Resources. But it's withstood all of those challenges, and it's ongoing. I wound up living there for a couple of years, and my role there was to reduce violence. It's a big, fuzzy term that who knows what that means, right? Grassy people invited Christian peacemaker teams to come up because they thought we could see violence from, they can imagine violence coming from truckers or loggers whose work lives are being disrupted and whose incomes are being disrupted. They could imagine violence coming from the police. They could imagine other protesters arriving to support them but not sharing their strategy and wanting to take a violent approach. They didn't want any of those things to happen and thought that it would be useful to have a couple pairs of outside eyes, people with connections to the media, and in Christian Peacemaker Team's case, connections to churches in the dominant culture, white churches. So we provided we witnessed what happened. We engaged with, we talked to the loggers, we talked to the police, we talked to the mayor in Kenora. Our purpose there was not to be mediators or to be neutral observers. We were there because we support the idea of what Grassy Narrows is trying to do, and we support their strategy to do it with the least amount of harm possible.
The blockade remains in place today, although logging trucks continue to enter and clear-cut Treaty 3 land from a different access point.
No logging happening close to the community. There is logging happening to the north of us, but to get to that place, we have to, it's about a 3 to 4 hour drive from where we are right now. So it's not convenient right now to do any blockading there.
First of all, it's important to understand that their traditional territory is about 2,500 square miles on the north and south sides of the English River. Before roads came in the 60s, they traveled using the river. So they went through that entire territory, trapping in the wintertime, fishing in spring and summer, picking blueberries, wild ricing. So they cover this entire circuit, this 2,500 square miles, supported a certain number of families. So some of that is accessible by road from the reserve, the part on the south side of the English River, and that's where most of the blockading happened. So in a area around the community, you don't see clear-cutting happening at the moment. North of the river is another story. To get there, you have to go out to Vermilion Bay in the north on the highway to Red Lake. So it's quite a... To mount blockades in those areas is logistically difficult. And there's also... You don't want to block a provincial road necessarily because you can be arrested for that. Blocking a logging road is something else. So these are strategic decisions that people in Grassy had to make. They have a limited amount of resources. They have a limited amount of time and energy. They're dealing with a lot of other... they're dealing with poverty and disease and other forms of colonial racism is coming at them. They can't do it all. So as things stand, blockades on the south side of the English River have slowed the logging. But Abitibi continues to send its contractors north of the river, and those are places that people do trap, do hunt up there, and they continue to experience that disruption.
Tensions run high in the nearby, mostly white community of Kenora, where the local economy relies heavily on forestry. Currently, an estimated 15,000 jobs are related to the forestry industry in northwestern Ontario.
And, you know, there's a fair number of people, and we should really add it all up, but, you know, every payday, there's so many people from this community that go to town and they spend their paychecks in Kenora. And there's 10 reserves right around Kenora. and all the people go to Kenora, and they do, you know, their shopping and buy cars and boats and.
So there's no money kept in the community at all.
There's no money.
It flows out.
The money flows out of the community and it flows into Kenora. So, Kenora's benefited tremendously from having the Aboriginal people around them and from the forest industry.
The latest development in the Grassy Narrows struggle has been the delivery of a letter to Abitibi and Warehouse chief executives warning them to, quote, immediately cease and desist from all logging and industrial resource extraction on our territory or face fierce international campaign.
The letter includes an SOS to the international environmental and human rights community to stand in solidarity with Grassy Narrows in their demands and expand the struggle in the woods, in the streets, and in the marketplace.
The Rainforest Action Network has been involved with Grassy Narrows for a few years now. About 6 months ago, they approached us, as well as a bunch of other NGOs, and asked us to become, you know, more involved in their campaign, because the blockade has been up for 3 years and they haven't seen all the results that they'd like to see. You know, they were asking us to help kind of turn this into the international controversy that it should be and that it rightfully is. But really, if we're going to impact this issue, it's going to take, you know, more than that. And you know, what I'd really encourage people to do is to take a look in your community, on your campus or in your city, and look for products that are made by Weyerhaeuser and products that are made by Abitibi. And you know, if those are being sold in your local coffee store or on your campus or you know, being used to build houses in your communities, then you know that's, you know, that is what's driving the destruction at Grassy Narrows, is our use of these products. And so we're asking people to adopt a retailer who's selling these products, or adopt your campus and get them to pass policies that say that they won't buy these kinds of products that come from Grassy Narrows, or products that come from other socially and ecologically destructive logging.